Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. It is 1:33 p.m. and we are in Belch Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, March 11th. Members present are Senator Merrick, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I'd like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Lisa Denny, and our LAO moderator, Joseph Giesbrecht. Today we have two items on our agenda. First up, Senate Bill 121, Pharmacies, Pharmacists, and Benefit Managers, and Senate Bill 203, Business License Fees. First up, we have Senate Bill 121, Pharmacies, Pharmacists, Benefit Managers. We've had two hearings on this bill, first on February 28th and again on March 6th. Today we have bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Kathy Geisel, here to give us a brief recap of the bill and to answer any questions that may have come up since our last hearing on the bill. Senator Geisel, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Geisel. I have the honor of representing Senate District E, that's South Anchorage down to Portage, including through the tunnel to Girdwood. Whittier. Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 121 today and continuing exploring this very complicated subject. Mr. Chairman, last week you heard a variety of public testimony, including from the Division of Retirement and Benefits, who offered comments related to their estimate of cost. Mr. Chairman, during a recent White House discussion on pharmacy benefit managers, Mark Cuban of the new innovative company called Cost Plus Drugs said the following, and I quote, "I genuinely believe that CEOs do not understand how their healthcare costs work, particularly as it applies to the rebates they receive from their PBMs. They tend to look at rebates as cash paid by drug manufacturers. Nothing could be further from the truth. The reality is the rebates are not paid by the drug manufacturers. The rebates are paid for by these companies' sickest and oldest employees," end quote. Mr. Chairman, I believe this is true, and I believe that our Alaska pharmacists with boots on the ground are going to be able to effectively demonstrate that PBM reforms in Senate Bill 121 will allow Alaska to enjoy cost savings on their health plans. You may be interested to know that last week, Idaho passed a PBM reform bill, House Bill 596, that contained many of the provisions of Senate Bill 121. 39 other states are currently deliberating PBM reforms this year. There's a reason for that. Alaska is not an outlier here. We have some very seasoned and courageous pharmacists who are going to bring forward the inequities that the PBM business model is executing here in our state. They can illustrate real savings for healthcare plans with these PBM reforms. So change is difficult, Mr. Chairman. It's a lot easier for opposition to Senate Bill 121 to instill fear of change than to actually prove how they're saving us money. States who have passed PBM reform bills, like Senate Bill 121, report savings in the millions. Thank you for digging into this. Mr. Chairman, in your packet, you have a bibliography. It's very lengthy. That's why we didn't give you actual copies of the articles. But if you take a look at that, you would see that it's hard to deny that PBM reform is desperately needed. Mr. Chairman, we have Dan Nelson here today. He's the director of pharmacy for Tenenbaum Chiefs Conference. And he was out of state last week. He's here today, and I hope he'll be available for invited testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Geisel. Are there any questions from members of the committee? I have a couple. Some folks who are supportive currently of pharmacy benefit managers have stated to me concerns that under provisions of this bill that their plans will no longer be able to provide maintenance drugs in the mail. Senator Geisel, does your bill outlaw the ability for plans to send maintenance drugs in the mail to pharmacy customers?
No, Mr. Chairman, this bill allows the choice to be made. local provided or mail order. It is an option.
Very well. Also, some folks have claimed that your bill would do away with in-network and out-of-network pharmacies and the ability for plans to establish networks as kind of a group of pharmacies that they've contracted to provide benefits for their plan. Does your bill do that?
Mr. Chairman, actually, that's a PBM contract. That's what the PBMs do. They mandate what pharmacy can be used by the consumer.
Thank you. To clarify, does your bill outlaw the practice of of a plan working with a group of pharmacies and kind of creating a network of those pharmacies? Under your bill, could a plan still go out and create a network and say, hey, these pharmacies are in our network and we want you to deal with these pharmacies?
You know, right now, Mr. Chairman, we have Optum as our PBM, and we, as subscribers to that that PBM, can use other pharmacies. We get a lower price if we choose the pharmacy that the PBM controls. So that bill doesn't change anything there.
Okay. Thank you.
No other questions?
Right. Up next, we're going to hear from Ron Nelson. Mr. Nelson, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Dan Nelson. I'm the director of pharmacy at Tandenaw Chiefs Conference up in Fairbanks, Alaska. And I'm representing Tandenaw Chiefs Conference here today. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about this important bill.
Thank you, Dan. Apologize for getting your name wrong.
I'm just going to jump right in, if that's okay.
I know it is.
Time is valuable here. So I'm going to talk about, Senator Giesel talked about the complexity of the issue that we're dealing with here in Senate Bill 121. That's why we've got a long bill. It is important to understand kind of the lay of land with reimbursement for pharmacy. So right now, the way it works, this slide shows the current reimbursement model, which is based off of two different aspects. One is the ingredient cost or drug product cost, and then also a professional dispensing fee. Right now, much of that is weighted on the actual ingredient cost. When we analyze the Division of Retirement Benefits data, 99.5% of the overall prescription drug spend was on the actual ingredient cost, and only 0.5% of the overall drug spend, prescription benefit spend, was on the professional dispensing fee. So that was very heavily weighted on the ingredient cost. What we're looking at with Senate Bill 121 is this lower graph here, where we're looking at a transparent model that looks at the actual acquisition cost, which is called the NADAC, or National Average Drug Acquisition Cost, plus a cost of dispensing, which is set by a survey of pharmacies, which would be overseen by the Commissioner of the Division of Insurance, as currently written in Senate Bill 121. So the overall net impact is that there is going to be an increase in the dispensing fee. We acknowledge that. But there's going to be a drastic decrease in the ingredient cost spend. So hopefully either a neutral or a potential cost savings. And we're going to jump right into some examples here next to kind of show you what's been spent in our analysis of the DRB data. So we're just going to jump in. I'm going to talk about three different drug examples. These are all multiple sclerosis drugs. They're all very expensive drugs. So this first one's called Tecfidera. When we looked at there were 93 prescriptions filled by Alaska retirees and current employees for this particular medication in 2022 when we evaluated the data. State of Alaska spent over $400,000, as you can see, in 2022 for those 93 prescriptions, so about $4,400 per prescription. Now, when we look at what this would be if we would have used the formula based off of Senate Bill 121, this includes, and we're estimating because we don't know what that dispensing fee is going to be set at by the Division of Insurance Commissioner, but we used the what has been used by PCMA and other groups of a $13.36 dispensing fee. Using that formula, we would be looking at an overall spend of about $35,000-$36,000. So as you can see, a drastic cost savings over 1,000%, so about $384 per prescription, just looking at that one drug alone. I'm going to move on to another example here. This second example that I have is a drug also for multiple sclerosis. This was only 32 prescriptions filled in 2022, and the state of Alaska spent almost, as you can see, almost $160,000 for those 32 prescriptions at a cost of roughly $4,800 per prescription is what was actually spent in 2022 paid by the state of Alaska.
Mr. Nelson, let's take a pause here. Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify something. So in these, in the proposed cost for SB 121, what are you using as a dispensing cost? Is it, you said $2 or $3, or is it, I think $13 was the number we've heard other folks use, but it's not clear, it's not in, not spelled out in the bill. So what's your number?
$13. What we used in these calculations was $13.36 that you're seeing on these slides right here.
Okay. So even with a $13 dispensing fee, you still, this is about half the price, it looks like.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I would also note that the location of where a prescription is filled can have a drastic impact on the overall reimbursement amount. So you will hear, I'm sure, from testifiers after me today that using specialty pharmacy is a mechanism to save costs. When we actually looked at the data where these prescriptions were filled, and when we look at prescriptions that were filled at a specialty pharmacy, the cost for this drug alone, it's black and white. It's in the data that we got from DRB, over $1,000 per prescription more spent at Optum Rx specialty pharmacy than other pharmacies. So this argument that using specialty pharmacy saves money does not hold water, and the proof's in the pudding.
I have a follow-up, Mr. Nelson.
Absolutely.
I like pudding. What's the difference between a specialty pharmacy and a regular pharmacy?
That's a very good question. And this is something that actually has been, for lack of a better term, the specialty pharmacy concept is something that's been essentially created out of thin air by the pharmaceutical benefit manager industry. There really is not a true generally accepted definition. Really what it boils down to is these are expensive drugs. There's not something different necessarily with their storage and handling, their counseling, their anything else. It's just that they are very expensive drugs. So I could spend a lot of time answering that question, but that is really what it boils down to. And if I could expand just one little bit more, that is really important to understand about this, because this is a critical issue. These are roughly 2% of our overall prescription drug volume that's filled in the United States, but it's over 50% of the overall drug spend. So by the PBMs siphoning those prescriptions off, that's really driving the cost of our prescription drugs up in the United States. So it's a critical issue to understand. And the fact that these drugs move on and off the specialty list once they become generic is again proof in the pudding that it's nothing special about the drug. It's special about the cost and the dollar associated with that particular drug.
Senator Bishop has a question.
Thank you. Thanks for coming today, Dan. And do you and your peers that work with you at your pharmacy, do you have the education, the training, the wherewithal, and A to Z? Can you handle these specialty drugs, or is that something that you need more education and training, et cetera, et cetera?
No, absolutely. We have the training, expertise, knowledge, the facilities, the infrastructure to do it. In fact, I would argue, particularly in the Alaskan environment, we do it much better. Tandon Chiefs Conference, for example, we serve, you know, roughly the geographic size of the state of Texas, and we pride ourselves on making sure that our patients out in the villages get their medications in a timely manner, in a way that they're not frozen. And that's a huge logistical challenge. It comes at great cost to us. And we have a whole set of infrastructure where we're working with our health aides, we're working with our patients, we're calling, we're putting stuff on Wright's Air, 40 Mile Air, Everett Air, and we are getting that stuff out to the patient and say, this flight is going to be out there at 11 o'clock in Huxley, Alaska, be there to pick it up, and they are there. And that prevents that medication from being ruined. When that same prescription comes from Florida and it gets sent to the United States Postal Service or FedEx, I would say 50% of those are wasted or ruined when they go out to our villages.
Thank you.
I have a question. What would be the change in experience to an insurance plan, and then what would be the change in experience to a person getting a prescription if there were more specialty pharmacies available to people? How would things change for an insurance plan, and how would things change for someone getting prescriptions if there were a larger number of specialty pharmacies?
I guess it kind of depends on how you cut that cookie. In some ways, I think this whole siphoning of bifurcating of specialty and non-specialty prescription drug, quote unquote prescription drugs, which again is kind of a made up term, is a really unhealthy thing, because what we look at as pharmacists, what our training is we look at the holistic person. So we're not looking at one drug or drug A or drug B. We're looking at they're on seven different drugs, and we want to know how they interact, how they work with that person's. I'm looking at their labs, their drug interactions, their renal function, their liver function, all these things together holistically. And when they're getting one prescription filled over here and six prescriptions filled over here, no one knows what's going on. And the fact of the matter is, to me, that's a dangerous situation, and it provides an inferior level of care. So I think by having more specialty pharmacies, it's actually a move in the wrong direction.
Okay. Other questions? Please continue.
Okay. Thank you very much. This third example is, again, is a third MS drug. And as you can see, this is, again, all 2022 data. We can look at what the state of Alaska paid for this drug called Ampira. This is a 10-milligram tablet. They spent about almost $200,000 for that to fill all the prescriptions for that particular drug. If we look at what would be reimbursed off of the Senate Bill 121 language, which is, again, the NADAC plus a $13.36 dispensing fee, which, again, is a bit of a guess, and it could be potentially slightly higher or lower. But as you can see, it's fractions, pennies on the dollar of what we would be spending or what was actually spent. And again, this is where those PBMs really are forcing these higher spend drugs. So hopefully that these couple of examples, we've got many more that we can share with you, and we'd be happy to do those. And we've really dug into these numbers and done the in-depth analysis that I think they're really, really powerful examples. So be happy to share any more examples with you guys that would potentially be helpful.
I have a question.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the fiscal note that we were presented by from the Department of Retirement and Benefits?
I sure am.
Would you say that on that fiscal note that they use the pricing calculations that you did here with your model by taking a look at the NADAC price that the bill calls out plus a dispensing fee to create that fiscal note?
Absolutely not. There's no way they could have.
How was that fiscal note created?
That's a very good question for DRB. My gut feeling, my personal opinion, is that they took what was mentioned in testimony, those different on-road, off-road dispensing fees, and they multiplied those by the prescription volume that the state filled in 2022. And they compared that to what their benchmark is of that 80 cent example of what their current average is, or their current max, which truly is quite frankly, a laughable calculation. It doesn't bring into the fact that you're not going to have any more spread pricing with Senate Bill 121, and also that we've got this whole, the ingredient cost is going to be coming down drastically, as I've just shown you in these three examples alone.
Pretty good.
So I wanted to show you an example on the left-hand side of this slide here that talks about spread pricing. So we've heard a lot about spread pricing. It's a little bit of a difficult concept for folks that aren't in this world to wrap your head around. But we looked at all claims dispensed at a particular pharmacy in Alaska in 2022 that were reimbursed under a dollar. So I think we can all think, like, Can we keep a business open by paying a pharmacy under a dollar to fill a prescription? And the flat out answer is no. And that's why pharmacies across the state are going out of business. So we looked at all of these prescriptions filled in 2022 that were reimbursed under a dollar, is about 70,000 prescriptions. 35,000 of those were reimbursed at about 47 cents on average per prescription, whereas the cost for that particular pharmacy just to buy the drugs, this is not overhead of the staffing, the labels, the vials, the keep the lights on, anything else, was over $10 just to purchase the drugs. So when we looked at what we have information that leads us to believe that what was actually charged to the plan, so that acquisition cost for those 35,000 prescriptions was about $366,000. What was reimbursed was only $16,000. We have reason to believe that the plan was actually charged $832,000 for those prescriptions, leaving a spread of what the PBM kept of over $816,000. So I think it goes to show the scale of some of this stuff. It's really drastic, and how many pharmacies are underwater on a huge percentage of claims. It's really a scary situation. The right-hand side, I know time is limited. I've probably already been talking too long here, but are some really good examples out of what I would say is a non-biased source, which is a physician who wrote this book about The Price We Pay, talks about the broken healthcare system, and I'll let you take a look at that and be happy to answer any questions about that if anyone has any. And then I think the other thing that kind of I would just end on here is that I don't want to leave this by coming across as that, you know, all the pharmacists are anti-PBM. That's not at all the case. We feel like there are good PBMs out there. There's actually getting to be more and more of them. Senator Giesel mentioned Mark Cuban's model. There's several others that have recently come in and are becoming much more competitive because employers, the lights are going on and starting to figure this out. But there are transparent PBMs. This one, as an example, is company out of the state of Kansas, where they do not have spread pricing. They don't retain the rebates. They don't require specialty pharmacy. They have a flat per prescription or per patient per month administrative fee. And so everything is above board, and they're saving municipalities hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars a year by going to this model. So I think it can be done. I just think that we really need to go back to the drawing boards, and we clearly have a very broken system right now. And I think Senate Bill 121 is a great first step in addressing some of those issues. So thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. How do you interface with a PBM? Do you have an annual meeting with them, or how does that work?
No, it really is kind of a David versus Goliath situation. These are some of the biggest companies in the world. So they're all the big three PBMs, Express Scripts, CVS, and OptumRx, part of United Health, are all in the top 15 of the Fortune 500 companies. And really the way that we interface is that we get either an email or a fax just randomly periodically with anywhere from 60 to 130 page contract that says, sign it if you want us to reimburse you and accept these terms flat out. And if you object to anything, change anything on there, you will be rejected flat out.
Follow up? Indeed. So you've never, with that being said, so you haven't even considered trying to negotiate the 130, anything on the 130?
Well, I I'm really glad that you asked that. It's kind of funny because I just about 3 months ago, I tried to do that. We got one that, it was just so laughable that I couldn't even like bring myself to sign it without saying something about it. So I did sign it, or I did fight. I struck something out. One of the things that they required is this thing. It's called a MAC pricing list, maximum allowable cost pricing list. This is used for generic drugs. And that is where the PBM sets their own price on generic drugs. It's not shared with the pharmacy, anything like that. Alaska state law, with the bill that was passed in 2018, requires that they do that, but they actually are not following through on it. So that is super frustrating. But regardless, they sent this contract that says, you will agree to accept the terms of our MAC pricing of multiple MAC pricing lists. And I said, well, no, we'll accept the one MAC pricing list and give me that. It's required by state law that you give me a copy of that MAC pricing list. And they said, absolutely not. You're not going to get it. You just have to. So you're signing a blank check is what you're doing. And I fought back and forth with them for 3 months on that before I finally just signed that on the line, or I wasn't going to be able to bill anything. It's totally take it or leave it 100%.
Last question.
Yep.
Would Would you be amenable to sitting down with these PBMs in a room and having a conversation if you could get you guys in the same room?
100%.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a number of folks with us today to speak about the impacts of Senate Bill 121 from their perspective. First up, we have Mary Stoll.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mary Stoll. I'm an attorney who's practiced in the area of ERISA and public sector health plans, mostly collectively bargained for the last 30 years. I'm here today on behalf of, the Pacific Health Coalition, which is a coalition of 49 health plans in five states, representing over 250,000 lives. 110,000 of those covered lives are here in the state of Alaska. When you consider that half the state population are federally beneficiaries of federal programs, it ends up working out to about one in every three Alaska citizens are represented by a plan that is a member of the Pacific Health Coalition. I asked the committee today to consider two questions before deciding whether to move this bill out of committee. And one is the bill preempted by ERISA? And the second is it fair and equitable to the working families in this state? And the first question, ERISA was passed over 50 years ago. It was intended to provide a consistent and nationwide set of laws and regulations for ERISA benefit plans, including health plans. And it has met that obligation for the last 50 years. In ERISA, it has a clause called the preemption clause. It says, insofar as any state law relates to an employee benefit plan, that it's preempted. The federal government has priority over that. And Oklahoma passed a law recently that was remarkably similar to Senate Bill 121. It restricted preferred and network pharmacies. It restricted mail order pharmacy. And the Tenth Circuit unanimously struck that law down as being preempted by ERISA. It was a PBM law, not a health plan law. But the net effect was that they were restricting a vendor, a third-party vendor, to the plan, which restricted the ERISA fiduciary's duty and obligation to design their plan for the best interests of their participants. In this situation, your ERISA fiduciaries are held both civilly and criminally liable if they are not utilizing fund assets for the sole and exclusive benefit of their participants. And they take their duties very seriously. With respect to their PBM contracts, there are choices. They negotiate those contracts. They decide to include those PBM contracts and the different aspects of them in their plan design. In the Mulready case, which was the Oklahoma case that I spoke of, the only case that has been decided by a circuit court in the United States, so it is the prevailing law, the court relied upon the United States Supreme Court, which said that insofar that a state law just impacts a cost to a plan, that that's not preempted. But if the regulation of a third-party vendor to the ERISA plan ends up causing the plan to change, exclude, or modify their plan design, it is specifically preempted. And this law does exactly what the Oklahoma law did. It does exactly what the Supreme Court said that they are not entitled to do, and that's to regulate ERISA plan trustees and fiduciaries' plan design. our trustees take their job very seriously. They are sophisticated in the contracts that they are negotiating with the PBMs. Things like spread is an option. You have an option for spread pricing. You don't have to include it. So that is taken into consideration with the assistance of professional consultants, PBM consultants that are hired to assist the plans in this respect. We audit, we RFP. There are audit provisions in each contract, so we can see what the cost and spend is. So our ERISA trustees are taking their jobs very, very seriously. And they cannot, if you can imagine, we have plans that cover many states. You have participants in more than one state. If every state has a different set of laws, it is not feasible to administer that ERISA plan. That's why ERISA put an umbrella over all regulation of plans and left it to the federal government to do that. If there are problems with PBMs, it should be handled by the federal government. You saw with the Affordable Care Act, they instituted the PCORI tax. That tax is a tax on the administrators for ERISA plans. Those administrators pass along that cost to the plan. But that's a federal law. Federal law is not preempted by federal law. State law is. And this is essentially a tax on these health plans. It's not going to hurt the PBMs. I think that it's misguided to think that those costs will not be passed on to the hardworking men and women who contribute, in many cases, through collective bargaining into their health plan. Those monies are earmarked, taken from their taxable wages, earmarked for their health benefit plan, and they're to be used for other purposes, such as an increase in a dispensing fee. That isn't benefiting the plan participant. That would be a breach of fiduciary duty by the trustees because they are not exercising their discretion over the assets of the plan for the sole and exclusive benefit of the participants. Those monies would run to the pharmacies. And it's not just your rural and independent pharmacies. That additional dispensing fee that we've heard about, that goes to all of them. That's to Walgreens, to Fred Meyer, to Kars, to pharmacies that are not struggling. So is that a fair, shift of cost from these individuals who are in a collectively bargained plan, who the employers set aside money for their health benefits, the union bargains for those monies, and those monies run to something other than prescriptions for those individuals for treatment of well baby checkups or some dread disease. Those monies aren't there. Fiduciaries have very limited levers that they can pull to deal with increased plan cost. They can implement cost containment provisions, such as the PBM contracts that have aggregate buying on such things as these very expensive drugs. You can buy them cheaper when you buy them in bulk. It's just a market condition. The next lever that they would have is to increase contribution. And I'm telling you right now, dealing with collectively bargained plans in this great state, the economy is not favoring additional contribution. Even for your public sector plans, they're being grossly underfunded by the employer contribution, and they're having to pull out every stop they can to avoid deficit spending, or worse yet, the third lever that they have, and that's to cut benefits or increase out-of-pocket costs and deductibles, which all hurts the hardworking men and women in this state. So it's my understanding that Representative Fields has asked for a alleged legal opinion as to the preemption issue, and I would urge you to look at the preemption issues very closely. We understand that there are bills pending in many different states, Washington as well as Idaho. Tennessee, Florida, Texas have passed these types of laws, and they will be litigated out because there is federal precedent at this point, and it's supported by the United States Supreme Court as to what preemption means to an ERISA plan. And with that, I'll take any questions, or I thank you for your time.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, we have a presentation in our packet from the Pacific Health Coalition. Is that you or is it someone else going to give
our
that presentation?
Our consultant Greg Loudon is here today for Pacific Health Coalition as well, and there are slides that go with that. You may be confusing his presentation with mine.
Are we going to hear that presentation as well, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair? Okay. Then I'll hold my questions on that until there, but I have a question for you. So in the case that came out of Oklahoma where it was struck down by the 10th Circuit, was the entire bill struck down, or were there certain severable provisions that were struck down? If so, what provisions are sort of analogous in this bill?
Okay. It would be the prohibition on network, preferred network, and specialty pharmacy networks, and also the prohibition on mandated, maintenance drug mail order. And to answer the second part of your question, when the 10th Circuit struck the law down, they remanded it back to the federal district court to determine what portions of the law are severable from those preempted issues and what they can support. And certainly, a state has a right to license, audit, and provide for administrative remedies for any businesses operating within its jurisdiction. That's appropriate. There were provisions in the bill as to those sections as well, and I presume that those will be upheld because it's appropriate for a state to be doing that. Where they went crosswise with the Tenth Circuit was on the preemption issue, that they were putting the ERISA plans in the untenable position of having to administer 50 different sets of laws. You simply can't do that. Every time we have a traveler come into the state because you don't have enough plumbers, for instance, or you need more laborers, or you need more Teamsters, they are filling prescriptions in this state under a plan that doesn't have the same rules as your state would then be laying down. It creates a nightmare solution for the plans.
Can I ask a follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
So I am leaving aside the – so you said there were two things, the in-network issue and then the prohibition on mail-order maintenance drugs were the two things that that the Tenth Circuit believed were preempted and caused
– the prohibition of specialty pharmacy as well.
So but the we've heard testimony today that this bill actually doesn't mandate that you can't do mail-order – maintenance drugs. So is that way this differs with the bill that was struck down in the Tenth Circuit? Or can you explain that to me?
Senator, my understanding of 121, the way it is written, that you cannot mandate mail order drugs. There are plans that do mandate it. It is not the norm generally after you've been on a prescription for 2 or 3 months and it's a maintenance type drug and it's working for you. You can opt into having it delivered mail order. So you get a 90-day script with no copay, no out-of-pocket. It works real well for keeping people compliant with their drug regime. They're mailed before they're out of the original prescription. But some plans do mandate that because there's a big cost savings to it. And it's also better for your participant because they don't have any out-of-pocket cost.
Okay. So an amendment that said for maintenance drugs, we will not prohibit mandating
I think they looked more at it with a preemption eye of, that's up to plan fiduciaries to decide what their plan term is. And if their plan term is you're taking a low-dose loprinosol for your blood pressure, it's going to come via mail because it's much less expensive for us. That saves money to treat the dread diseases or add wellness programs or do something additional for those members that the fiduciaries are charged with their sole and exclusive interest.
And one last thought, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
Alaska is a pretty unique state when it comes to our mail system and when it comes to our temperatures. You know, a lot of places don't have mailboxes, for example, to go to. Are you saying that if a plan mandated the delivery of some drug that we know was going to spoil at 50%, for example, in rural areas, there's nothing the state can do about that?
There's something the plan can do about that, and our prescription benefit managers do not, through their mail order pharmacies, send drugs that are environmentally sensitive to environmentally rough places like Alaska. We heard in testimony the first hearing on 121 that insulin was dropped on the doorstep in Fairbanks and it froze and it was wasted. That hasn't happened in any instance with the Pacific Health Coalition in our mail order program. Again, it's 1 in 3 of your citizens in the state of Alaska. And over the last 2 years, we had 2 instances, according to National Cooperative RX, our monitor of our PBM, 2 instances where drugs did not arrive timely. They did a manual override, and they were filled the same day at a retail pharmacy.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question just on the statistic you threw out there.
Certainly.
Your plan in Alaska covers 110,000 lives, is that correct?
Yes, sir. And
so about 1 in 7.
It would be 1 in 7, except you have about half the population of the state of Alaska is on a federal program such as IHS, and they are not in that calculation. They are not the private sector or your public sector trust such as ASCA or Alaska Care. But Alaska Care is not in our PBM arrangement.
Very well. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Ms. Stoll, can you tell me again what you do? I know, are you just the legal counsel? So give me a little background on what you do, because I don't play gotcha. So it's going to help me frame my several questions I have.
No problem. Senator, I started my career before I went to law school doing plant administration. I went to law school, I came out, I went to work for the Laborers Trust, Washington, Northern Idaho, District Council of Laborers and their trusts in Washington. I have worked with, as a consulting attorney, negotiating contracts, keeping them in compliance with the Department of Labor, the Internal Revenue Service, all of your federally required filings, as well as litigation. I represent four large health plans here in the state of Alaska, including the Alaska State Employee Association, AFSCME, Local 52 Health Benefit Trust, Public Employees Local 72, APEA AFT, United UA 367 Health Trust.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yep.
So do you do any day-to-day negotiations between the PBM and the trust?
This is why the PBM contract is managed by a PBM consulting firm. They do our RFPs. They do the auditing. It's National Cooperative RX. It is a coalition of coalitions and not-for-profit. And they have the aggregated clout in order to negotiate on an even basis with the PBMs.
Follow up?
Yep.
So I'm a 50-year member of the Operating Engineers Local 302. So yeah, I think you've heard of us. Mm-hmm. So I've got a little experience with as you say, get in the handcuffs if you don't fiduciary manage the membership's money in an equitable fashion and above board. But what was given, and the reason I'm going down this line of questioning is, so how can you make me feel comfortable that my trustees are getting accurate information from the PBMs? Is it a closed book? Are they showing us the books? Because I'm blessing this plan. So how can you you told me now we've got a middleman that manages with the PBM. Who's showing you the books so you can guarantee your trustees that they're not going to jail?
Okay. National Cooperative RX reports back to us on their findings with their RFPs and their investigations and audits of the PBMs. They report to the Pacific Health Coalition. Their member plans are privy to that information, either through their counsel, their consultant, most likely from their consultant, who is the number crunchers. I'm not going to give myself credit for being a math whiz. I don't do the number crunching. But I have a high degree of confidence that we are getting the information that we need. I do not agree with everything that PBMs do. I think there are transparency problems. The transparency bills are being addressed at a federal level. They aren't moving as fast as anything should on a federal level, but that's where it belongs. It's a federal law. Federal law should control what happens to ERISA plans.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Further questions? I have questions.
Certainly.
Certainly not a constitutional lawyer, but teaching history and for government for a while, dealt with a lot of Supreme Court cases. And the case you mentioned was decided in the 10th Circuit. However, in 2020, there was a Supreme Court decision. We haven't heard anything from you about that case today. Could you describe
Rutledge versus
PCMA? Could you describe what the case did and why that is important to our conversation if we're talking about constitutional law provisions and ERISA plans?
I would not call it necessarily a constitutional law decision. The Supreme Court, it had been appealed to that point. It was an Arkansas law that dealt with the relationship between the PBM and the pharmacy, and it involved a cost. It was an additional cost, and unfortunately that cost would get passed down to the health plans that are going to bear the cost because the PBM is not. They're a vendor. The court specifically stated in that instance that although it is a cost imposed through the third-party vendor to the health plan, it's a cost. It's not driving plan design change. It's not saying that we mandate that you cannot have specialty pharmacy networks or preferred pharmacy networks or how you deliver your drugs versus via mail order. And the court in Rutledge specifically stated, had it been something that drove plan design, that it would have been preempted. But in this instance, it was an ancillary cost to the plan.
So are you saying that something like a dispensing fee would be allowed under Rutledge, but according to your interpretation of the majority decision in Rutledge, that you wouldn't be able to mandate delivery?
Correct.
Be able to mandate.
Is it a plan design issue to be determined by the plan fiduciaries?
Understood. In the 90s, there was a case, Travelers versus New York, which also dealt with ERISA plans and different hospital fees. How would that plan speak to PBMs having different price structures for their network pharmacies or out-of-network pharmacies, in your opinion?
Well, Travelers dealt with a tax on the hospitals in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It did not deal with a pricing issue between the PBMs and the plan. And as I said, the plans contract with the PBMs. The bill we have before us is a PBM bill. No slicing, dicing that. It's about PBMs. But the net effect of it is to drive and mandate plan design changes by your ERISA plans. And when you speak to the dispensing fee for the Pacific Health Coalition plans alone, it increases their yearly cost by $2.7 million. They're currently at $4. That's a $9.36 delta for every prescription. And again, I ask you, first question, is it preempted? Second question, is it fair and equitable? Why would these men and women who set money aside through the collective bargaining process be required to fund a private entity at a level that's higher than they have already negotiated?
That's an interesting question. So the parties here that disagree on the facts, they don't disagree on a little bit. They disagree on a lot, 3,000% a lot. And you've mentioned negotiated agreements and collective bargaining quite a few times. And if I'm paying money out of my check every month, I want to know that the cost of the benefits that my team is negotiating for me actually are less. And I want to know that the arrangements that have been made actually save me money.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to believe that even 10% of what these pharmacists are telling us are true, you had better believe that I'm going to be asking some hard questions about what my union dues are worth.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't get great answers, probably not going to pay those dues anymore.
Senator, I agree with you.
And so as we look at the data that's here,
mm-hmm.
we need to have a good conversation about why these differences in the numbers exist and what they are. Because until we come to some agreement on, okay, here's the average cost that NADAC sets, and here's what the plan paid out, why are those numbers different? Until I hear some kind of rational answer as to why those numbers are so different, I'm going to have a hard time believing folks like you who tell me that your members are getting a good deal.
Senator,
I have a really hard time believing that.
Mr. Greg Loudon is going to be testifying after me. He is the consultant to the Pacific Health Coalition and consultant to many of the plans that I have discussed. And he has those numbers and graphs.
Great.
And we do disagree on that. You're right. There's 3,000% different. But I ask you to listen to
his
testimony as well.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Up next, we have Greg Loudon.
My name is Greg Loudon. I'm the vice president and account executive with Parker Smith & Feek. We're a commercial insurance brokerage and consulting firm and based in Anchorage. I'm born and raised in Alaska. I grew up in Fairbanks and also an Alaska native. Okay, so we're talking about the Pacific Health Coalition, and I might be able to enlighten some of the questions that were asked earlier of my colleague Mary Stoll. Pacific Health Coalition is one of my clients. I am an employee benefit consultant for them, so I help them in contracting with PBMs, with hospitals, with primary care providers, a lot of different types of groups. The Pacific Health Coalition provides group contracting for self-insured health plans. So we try to aggregate volume amongst all the people that we cover and negotiate it on behalf of a much larger group. This slide gives you some of the details on us. You heard from Mary Stoll. Our Alaska membership is 29 health plans and covering 110,000 lives in Alaska. It's made up of a number of public entities and labor management trusts. So why do we oppose this bill? Senate Bill 121 increases cost to our members. It reduces our ability to manage costs, steer members to high-quality pharmacies, and trade volume for reduced rates. And that last bullet is an important distinction. When we're asking for discounts with network pharmacies or building networks, we can't just come with our hat out asking for discounts. We have to have something to offer in exchange. And that's normally done by us giving volume to the vendor. The more volume that we get, the better price rate that we're able to receive. And our hardworking families that have recently faced unprecedented inflation, wages have not been able to keep up. Workers have traded compensation for benefit packages, and now we're seeing it diminished solely to help one group.
Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on this bill, this slide, if you go back, it says steer members to high quality pharmacies. What's a high quality pharmacy? And is your assertion that the independent pharmacies in Alaska that are asking for this bill are not high quality pharmacies?
I would suggest that there are probably some pharmacies that are not high quality. Not casting stones on any particular group. We have had examples that we did not pull out, like we saw some of the pro side do on specific bad instances, but we've had some really negative interactions with some pharmacies that didn't provide the kind of oversight and quality value that we like for our membership.
Can I have a little more detail about that? So what do you mean? So again, high quality, can you give me an example of sort of the practices of a high quality pharmacy versus a low quality pharmacy?
Yeah, we heard testimony earlier today from Tanana Chiefs, and they described what they do for their catchment area and their geography, where they actively manage specialty products for people in that geographic area. I would say that's a high-quality pharmacy that's able to provide real value for their members. They can do blood tests to find out how a drug is affecting the individual member. They can adjust medication. They can switch to a different one, change the amount. We have some pharmacies that, one or two people that are running it in a small rural place, and they just don't have the capacity to be able to provide those kinds of oversight. So it's one of the things that the PBMs do for our health plans. It's not just to negotiate discounts. It's not all about money. It's also making sure that we have good quality providers that are following those best practices for our members.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just wanted to mention, we do have a complicated relationship with PBMs, and I think this is worth noting because last week we heard some testimony that the PBMs were behind us in trying to get our group and other groups to testify against this bill. And I just would like to mention that they do provide a needed and valuable service. They do things that we can't do on our own. There's no way that our group, even as large as the Pacific Health Coalition is, could go out and negotiate contracts with, hundreds of manufacturers of drugs or thousands of pharmacies to make sure that we had enough adequate supply and a distribution chain to provide drugs to our members. So we rely on them to do that. Sometimes we don't like them. And I've, you know, cast aspersions or dispersions on PBMs many times in my career. It is a complicated business. There's nothing easy about this. And sometimes you have to look to make sure that they're really doing the right thing for you. Consider vendors like cell phone companies, cable TV, car dealerships, same kind of things that I'm sure that you each have in your own lives, where you have a vendor that provides a service you can't do on your own, but you may not exactly enjoy the interaction. Plan sponsors and trustees hire, fire, and manage the services that are provided by the PBMs, and I think that's an important distinction. Mary Stoll spoke about the fiduciary responsibility of trustees that are running a health plan. Through the chair, Senator Bishop asked a question about Local 302, and Local 302 is a member of the Pacific Health Coalition, but they don't participate in our PBM contract. They actually do their own thing. But the trustees on that plan have an obligation to make sure that they do know what they're getting. And I know that they've got a very good benefit consultant that does help them with that. I can't speak to the particulars of it because they're not part of our group. But for those plans that are part of our group, they can rely on the services that we provide to make sure that oversight is being done.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Loudon. So you talked about, you know, you say right here, we don't always like them. You got any suggestions on how to make this bill better so we could all like each other and get, because I'll agree with this chairman. We got this side of the issue. We got this side of the issue. Somewhere in the middle, we got to find some common ground. So if you got any suggestions, and you don't have to say anything now, but I'm sure the chair and I and the rest of the committee would entertain what that would look like.
Yeah, through the chair, I think that we could come up with some good recommendations. This bill in its totality is pretty difficult for us. It's hard to say that specific amendments that we would put forth that would make this palatable to us. I think one of the position that many of us feel in private industry is that caught a little off guard that there wasn't a lot more discussion with stakeholders involved to come up with some provisions for this bill that really could have helped everybody. I believe that there's been a lot of things that are taken out of context. Chairman Bjorkman mentioned there's disputes and facts, and I think it's hard for you as legislators to make really good sound decisions on legislation put forth when the stakeholders don't even agree on what the facts are.
Thank you.
So how is the Pacific Health Coalition engaged to contract with PBMs? So back in early 2000s, Pacific Health Coalition used to negotiate direct contracts with PBMs, and we had three or four different contracts that we had. There's been a lot of change in the PBM industry since that time. Mid-2000s, we came across National Cooperative RX, which is another coalition that is focused specifically on negotiating and managing PBM contracts. And National Cooperative RX is based out of Wisconsin. They have 315 health plans under that group and 480,000 lives. They have quite a large staff that work just for the nonprofit. They do independent auditing with their own on-staff auditors. They hire outside auditing firms to make sure that the provisions of the PBM contracts are doing what the contract says that they should. We get pricing guarantees from them. So we know that there's maximums that we'll pay. There's always floating number points. Again, this business is very complicated, and it's really hard for even people that are in the business to understand, let alone laymen. We do get 100% return of rebates, and I just want to draw that out because that is one of the disputes, in fact, that I think we have with the pro side on this bill, is that we do get 100% return of rebates. We have it by contract, we audit it, and we know that we get that money back. National Cooperative RX has a team of pharmacists that are able to evaluate clinical programs and recommend cost containment programs. And a lot of times when a PBM comes to a health plan or an employer that is providing benefits, they'll recommend a some sort of cost containment program, we always have to look at what's behind that. Like, who's benefiting from this? Where's the money coming from? Sometimes it's something that is being distributed by pharma, and it's going to benefit pharma because they're getting more money for markup on a brand drug than they would on a similar generic.
Senator Dunbar has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask this question in a couple of slides. I think there's some other slides here where it impacts as well. But when you said the 100% return on rebates that's happening for you, and obviously there are provisions in this bill that are trying to kind of make that happen, right? So I guess my question is, my assumption is you don't oppose those parts of the bill, right? I mean, you're already doing it. This gets back to what sort of the chairman said. Like, we have someone saying the facts are here and someone else saying the facts are here. What you're saying is actually we already get this. So if we mandate it, it has no actual impact on you, right? So you wouldn't impose those parts of the bill. Perhaps there are other people, though, not you, other coalition, you know, folks that don't have the sophistication that you have that maybe aren't getting those return of rebates. Is that possible?
Through the chair, that's a possibility. The reason that we oppose it and that specific provision is just because it takes away another tool for cost containment that we have. There's been a lot of discussion about spread pricing. This kind of factors into that. So spread pricing is, we see it as an option. It's a contract tool. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just, it is what it is. You can either have a transparent contract that tells you exactly what your dispensing fees are, your ingredient costs of a particular pharmacy, or you have a generic contract that says, here's the guarantees you have on a discount off of some national, you know, rate sheet for the ingredient cost and a set number for the dispensing fee. One of the places that can be made up in a spread pricing contract is on rebates. And so there are employers that enter into contracts with either their health insurer or their PBM to give up part of the rebates. That way they don't have to pay a separate administration cost.
But it's not something you do. I mean, you get 100% of the rebates.
Through the chair, we get 100% of our rebates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a question. So if you're looking at, as far as impacts to your plan and impacts to your plan members, what this bill sets forward is we don't want members to pay any more a cost that we don't know. It's my interpretation of what's happening. You can let me know what you think about it. I don't know the prescription cost that your plan paid. I would assume you have that data and could very easily make a comparison for this committee or for your plan members. If I'm a member of your plan watching this committee hearing, I'm asking myself the question, well, I really want to see the difference between what my plan paid and what the NADAC pricing list is. Those are the two data points that I want. And so if I'm a member of the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District Healthcare Committee and I'm looking at the run sheets for what my plan paid out for prescriptions, I want to say, well, shucks, this plan is saying that I could pay NADAC or I could pay a list of costs for prescription drugs that's somewhere out there that only certain people can know. Do I have that right so far?
Maybe. I'm not an expert in pricing on NADAC versus average wholesale price, et cetera. I wouldn't pretend to be. I will tell you that during the discussion that we had earlier on the couple of carve-out multiple sclerosis drugs, I did text back to National Cooperative RX just ask about those specific drugs. Their belief on that is that those were pulled out of context. There are examples like that probably exist even within our contract where they might be extremely high compared to other drugs because we favor another drug over that one. So there's a preferred pricing on one drug, and rather than eliminate it from the formulary and say you can't have this drug, we keep it in. It just costs more money.
Be that as it may, I couldn't tell the difference if that was 100% true or some version of not true.
Yeah.
What I'm interested to know, and what your members should be interested to know, is take a one-year look back on your prescription costs that your plan paid for.
what are your runs for your prescription cost? And what I'm interested in to know is, what is the difference between what your plan paid, what came out of your members' pockets to pay, and then what is the NADAC pricing that the plan would have paid if this bill would have been into effect? That's the question that I would like to see data on. Thanks. Please continue.
Thanks. Okay, so how much do we spend? So the Pacific Health Coalition has a contract through National Cooperative RX, nonprofit, as we talked about. It's an option for our PHC member plans. So when we offer products, we don't mandate any of the groups that are part of the coalition. They don't have to use product contracts we set up. It's just like a menu of choice, and they can pick off the menu what they want to use and what they don't. So we have 10 of our Alaska-based groups that have 24,000 lives that participate in our contract, and including our lower 48-based members that have utilization in Alaska, we spent $43.5 million a year on prescriptions dispensed here. All right. How will Senate Bill 121 affect our costs? So I'd like to present this as the untold fiscal note. This is the negative financial impact to private industry. Our belief is that there's nothing in this bill for us. So this shows a specialty pharmacy lost opportunity. Of the 10 plans that I discussed, only 5 of our plans use an exclusive specialty pharmacy. They save 2% of their specialty RX spend for a savings of $140,000 a year. So it's not a huge amount of money, but it is significant. And again, we're able to trade that. We get a rate discount because we're able to send our volume to that particular pharmacy. If we apply that same opportunity to all of our specialty spend in Alaska, we just say that we had other plans that wanted to do that that don't participate in it currently, the spend in Alaska would be about $750,000. We heard earlier that there is no need for specialty pharmacies, or may not be any such thing as a specialty pharmacy. A regular pharmacy can handle any of those complex needs from those expensive drugs that we would normally typically describe as a specialty. Special medications require special dosage, handling, administration, and storage. They have to be injected often or infused. Treat complex, chronic, or rare conditions like cancer, HIV, AIDS, multiple sclerosis, or rare genetic orders like hemophilia. Most specialty pharmacies have departments dedicated to helping patients find financial assistance to pay for them. So it's not just the administration of the drug, but it's also how are you as an individual going to pay for this? And this is probably worth taking a step back and talking about plan design for specialty. We talk about spread pricing versus transparency. There's reasons why a plan sponsor might choose to engage in spread pricing instead of in transparency, because they want to limit one component, an admin cost, or some portion of their plan. Specialty is a way that that they can impact their savings for their members. So there are plans out there that will limit the total out-of-pocket cost to their members. It might be by a couple $100s, and that they don't have to pay anything more than that. There are some that will say it's a percentage of the cost of the drug. And if you're talking about a drug that's $35,000 a month and your coinsurance percentage is 10% of that, this can be tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars for an individual that's taking one of these extremely expensive drugs.
Question. Senator Dunbar's question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So other states are out in front of us on these bills, right? They have already done some of these things. The states that have banned the specialty pharmacy practice, or the mandated use of special pharmacy, have those plans seen a significant increase in costs?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's pretty new. And there's been a big push by the American Pharmacists Association on bills just like this across the states, and I think that it's too early to say.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
Actually, not a follow-up, a little bit different question. So only 5 of your plans use it. Why don't the other plans use it?
They just made different choices. They might have decided that they don't want to contract with a single specialty pharmacy and force people to go through that. Some of them allow their members to go to other pharmacies that are out there. That's a choice that is should be made by the employer plan sponsors and either give choice to their members or not. Some plans value choice significantly over cost.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue.
Earlier we heard from Tanana Chiefs, and I guess my comment on that is that I would suggest that they actually are the specialty pharmacy for their area. I'm also an Indian Health Service beneficiary myself, and I don't use Tanana Chiefs. I actually use South Central Foundation in Anchorage, the South Central area. As an IHS beneficiary, if I want to use a mail order service, I can only go through their mail order service that they've got. I don't have choice of pharmacies. I can only go to their pharmacy. So that's where I have to go to get my refills, either directly through them or mail order from them. Just kind of an interesting fact. Mail order. So we talk about exclusive mail order. So out of our 10 plans that have our contract, only one of them has exclusive mail order. This is a relatively insignificant cost for us, but I thought it was worth pointing out. They save 2% of their total prescription drug spend for savings of $28,000 a year. And calculating the loss of mail order savings for other groups, because we have a lot of groups that offer mail order, they just don't make it. It's not mandated. It's just voluntary. And as we heard earlier, there's a lot of people, especially for maintenance drugs, they don't like having to go into the pharmacy and pick stuff up. They would rather have it shipped to them, get a 90-day supply. But that still impacts our plans because we get discounts when we send volume through one pharmacy. So if we're able to negotiate and we send all that volume through to a mail order pharmacy, we get a discount on that cost. It's cheaper for everybody. And one of the things that this bill does, my understanding, is that it reduces our ability to influence members to go to a mail order pharmacy. So we can't give them either a higher cost if they want to go to a local retail pharmacy where the costs are higher, or lower their costs if they want to use mail order. Okay, increased dispensing fees. So this is by far the largest negative financial impact to our plans. And we've heard a lot of numbers kind of thrown around about what this will be. I did hear last week that the numbers that were built in on the fiscal note for this, there was a range of costs for dispensing fees under Medicare between $13 and 26 cents for groups that are out of Alaska. On the road system was $15 and 86 cents. And if it's off the road system, it was $23 and 78 cents. Well, we decided to be conservative in this. We used the lowest number, which is $13.26, and we said that, we asked about what the average dispensing fees in Alaska are that are paid by commercial contract. Got a number of $4. So the net increase per script is $9.36. So utilizing that, we calculated for our groups that the increase in dispensing fees is going to be $2.7 million. We extrapolated that using the average number of scripts that we have per person for all the other members that are part of the Pacific Health Coalition that don't participate in our PBM contract. Our estimate is it would be about $7.8 million that it would cost in increased dispensing fees for our organization alone. And then we pulled the number from the Kaiser Family Foundation. The most recent numbers that they had were from 2019. It was about, you see the numbers up here, came out to $27.5 million in increased dispensing fees just for commercial and cash payers. So that's excluding Medicare, Medicaid, any federal plans. The $2.7 million that I show for our groups is a staggering 6% increase in our total prescription drug spend for our plans. It's a lot of money. Earlier question was asked about the NADAC pricing and the specific MS drugs that we had. I don't have the answers on that, but we'll certainly look it up after this and report back to the chair. However, I believe those are low-frequency drugs where we don't see a lot of them dispensed, and unfortunately, the increased dispensing fee is on every single drug. So we're trying to come up with some analogies to be able to make this a little more relatable for people about how we look at this. We appreciate the fact that state government's concerned about the local pharmacies. And there have been some of them that have closed down. We've all heard of that testimony and not disagreeing. If state government was concerned about local grocery stores, the equivalent would be to add a $9.36 per meal fee onto groceries that are purchased by restaurants and households. You know, nobody would do that. We're concerned about local gas stations, we'd add a $9.36 per fill-up fee to trucking companies and to car owners. We're concerned about the local hardware stores, add a $9.36 per purchase fee to every purchase of hardware goods. And in every one of these cases, it doesn't just help or benefit the local store that's being disadvantaged, maybe put out of business by their competitors. It also helps the large multinational firms that operate here and raises the cost to the end users, like our members. I would suggest that this is not an injection of cash to our local economy as it was framed. This is government confiscating money from hardworking employees and redistributing it to large and small pharmacy owners. Thank you.
Senator Bishop. On your last two statements, I'll just reiterate what I said a little earlier. If you got any good ideas with your group and the PBMs and how to get a savings to pass it on to the hardworking Alaskans, because I know that you guys have got some concerns as well, we would be all ears on what that would look like.
Through the chair, we'd be happy to.
Yeah, to reiterate just real quick in the interest of time, we're probably not going to get to Senate Bill 203 today. We'll try to finish up at about 3:15, unfortunately. I would say in members' interests, take a year look back. Look at what the NADAC pricing was for a year compared to what your plan spent on drugs. If you're getting a good deal for your plan members, show them the money. Show them where the money's at. If they're getting a good deal, great. If they're not, we probably should look at some other options. Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Derek Musto joining us via the Teams Hub. Mr. Musto, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name and location for the record. Begin your presentation.
Hello, I am setting up my camera for you. I apologize. Hopefully you can see me. My name is Derek Musto. I'm thankful to be here today. I work for Teamsters Local 959, and I'm one of eight union and employer trustees, four on each side for the Alaska Teamster Employer Welfare Trust. I would like to speak on SB 121 and comment on a few of the negative impacts this bill would have on our plan and many public and private self-funded plans across Alaska. Before I begin, I'd like to first thank the bill sponsor, Senator Giesel, and her staff, as we've previously had discussions on some of our concerns prior to today's hearing. I'd also like to thank Chair Brockman and the rest of the committee for hearing this legislation. Last week, Senator Giesel stated in her opening comments to the committee that, quote, there's no business model that comes close to the level of complication that pharmacy benefit managers operate under. She also said it requires diligent effort to peel back the layers of opaqueness that make up their model. It's truly daunting. I wanted to reiterate her comment because I absolutely agree with the statement. However, I disagree that this bill is the proper vehicle to truly address the PBM matrix and pharmaceutical costs across the board. As both a union representative and a labor trustee, I wear dual hats, and I'm charged with the responsibility for negotiating health and welfare dollars for our members, as well as being responsible for controlling plan costs and plan design. As a trustee, I'm a fiduciary. I'm regularly advised by expert consultants and attorneys to make decisions that are in the best interest of our members and their families. Our plan utilizes a transparent RFP contracting process, and we're very aggressive and not afraid to use that. We have a specialized PBM consultant that has years of experience in the inner workings behind the curtain of PBMs and knows how they operate. Our PBM consultant advises us how to secure contractually required guarantees that provide us the ability to audit, control, or reduce our pharmacy spend. Some PBMs will refuse to accept transparent terms, but I can assure you that a number of PBMs will. And I've attended training around the nation on this, and I've actually heard pharmacists that have advocated for a lot of these types of controls, cost measures, or recommendations. Trustees are civilly and criminally liable for their actions and using plan assets for anything other than reasonable costs of administering and providing benefits under the plan. Due to this, I take my responsibility seriously, and I aggressively work to be at the vanguard when seeking cost savings measures and considering plan design. I make sure to have conversations with plan professionals that know this intimately. While this legislation is intended to reduce PBM profits, the reality is this bill will put a strain on our health trust and other Alaskan plans. It'll strip important cost savings mechanisms currently used to lower participant costs and will add mandatory dispensing fees and additional costs to plans that do not provide a participant or their family member a benefit. As a trustee, I have significant concerns about the negative impacts of this bill and how it will directly impact our plan and, most importantly, our members. Measures that deprive our ability to establish a pharmacy network benefit design, use preferred or exclusive pharmacy networks, or remove access to programs that benefit our members directly conflict with my responsibilities as a trustee. Cost-controlling measures like the settings of copays, coupon savings programs for specialty and non-specialty drugs alike, mandatory mail order, for maintenance medications, securing a drug rebates, all of these things, they offer significant savings to plans and their participants. For example, after moving to mandatory mail order for our own plan, there were a small amount of complaints initially, but they went away and we have not had significant issues at all. So I would echo my general experience of what Greg Loudon had previously said. Mail order can provide plans with a convenient method of getting medication to participants at not only a reduced cost, it can have improved outcomes. I recently became aware of a 2010 study for patients with diabetes. Kaiser found that using a mail order pharmacy was associated with an increased medication adherence of 7 to 8% if they refilled their medications by mail versus local pharmacies. I'm a union rep. I believe in local. Buy local, spend local. But at the end of the day, these are negotiated dollars and decisions have to be made on the benefit of the participant. How do we maximize that? This bill will subsidize local pharmacies at the expense of Alaskans and their families, and it'll likely increase the use of unfavorable cost savings measures like benefit cuts, increased deductibles, and larger out-of-pocket expenses that do nothing more than shift the burden onto the individual participant. In closing, in my opinion, this bill will increase costs. This bill provides little to no benefit to the Alaskan economy and would require plans to utilize plan assets for unreasonable costs, preventing plans, both union and non-union, private and public, nonprofit and for-profit, from utilizing certain proven prescription drug cost savings mechanisms, unnecessarily stretching employee and employer dollars alike to cover our workers' needs and subsidizing those local pharmacies. In my view, the state should not divert negotiated dollars from a plan to support private business. If there's a true need to help independent pharmacies in various communities around Alaska, in my view, the state should use urban development dollars or other tools for those that need support, not increase the revenue to all pharmacies that include the large ones like Walgreens, Target, Fred Meyer, Walmart. I could go on, but you know, I don't think that's right to put it at the expense of Alaskans. In closing, I respectfully ask that you oppose this passage, and I'd be happy to answer any questions I can answer.
Thank you very much. Mr. Musto, on behalf of your members, you testified that you thought this plan was going to cost your members more money. Do you know the difference between the NADAC cost plus dispensing fees as proposed in this bill and what your overall plan spend was on prescription drugs for last year?
What I can tell you is this. when it comes to spread pricing or pass-through pricing, you know, including what you're referencing, I defer to our plan professionals. We recently went through a massive RFP process where we pretty much put everything on the table, and we were uber aggressive in the mandates that we had to have in our PBM contract. It's my understanding there's some plans in Alaska that don't have the ability to audit their PBM contract. We're confident that we got the absolute best benefit that we could, and we do utilize the coalition whenever that is a superior benefit to what we've been able to maintain. So I would not have a problem having a follow-up conversation with you and our specialty PBM consultant. And I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. I heard you answer no. What I would encourage you to do on behalf of your members, who you do have a fiduciary duty to, is take a year cast, look back at what you spent on prescription drugs under the status quo current system, and then apply Senate Bill 121, this model, to your plan experience. And come back and please tell the committee, would your members have saved money under this proposed bill, or did they save money by allowing you to negotiate under the status quo for your PBM benefit? That's what I'm interested in, and that's what I think your members should be interested in too. Because if on behalf of your membership you're telling this committee that you're saving members money and that the legislature stands to cost your membership more money, that's an answer we need to have. And that's a claim that I certainly can't support, because there's such a disparate understanding of the data right now. But if you have access to your runs for your prescription drug cost, and we can look at what the NADAC pricing was for 2023, we can have the answer. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Musto? All right, next up, Brenda Schneider. Ms. Schneider, please put yourself on the record. Begin your testimony. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Good afternoon, Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Brenda Schneider, State Government Affairs Director for CVS Health, joining from Tacoma, Washington, and speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 121. As I previously shared, Senate Bill 121 will significantly increase prescription drug costs in Alaska. Employers, insurers, and governments choose to contract with PBMs as part of their health plan offering to administer the prescription drug portion of the healthcare benefit. PBMs such as CVS Caremark offer a menu of options for employers and plan sponsors to choose from, and plan sponsors determine the design and PBMs administer those benefits. As you've heard others mention, there are several concerning provisions in this bill that eliminate the cost control measures that plan sponsors choose to utilize. Senate Bill 121 bans insurers from offering lower cost individuals managing chronic conditions who receive their prescriptions by home delivery. Mail order pharmacies are particularly important to chronically ill individuals on maintenance medications that help manage conditions like diabetes, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. Many plans choose to provide financial benefits like reduced or limited co-pays for members that choose to use a home delivery option, or they may require members to receive certain maintenance or generic drugs through the mail, which allows them to provide members with the lowest possible premiums, co-pays, and other cost-sharing amounts. Senate Bill 121 also prohibits insurers from offering more affordable pharmacy options to those who require the high-cost specialty medications we talked about today. This bill would prevent insurers from offering lower-cost pharmacy options to their members by effectively banning preferred pharmacy networks, including those exclusive specialty pharmacy arrangements. Just as insurers use preferred networks of doctors, hospitals, and other providers, they rely on preferred pharmacy networks to help benefit costs lower for consumers and small businesses, to keep benefit costs lower, This bill also prevents a patient's insurer from communicating with the patient about certain pharmacies offering a lower cost option for that prescription. That's simply anti-competitive and would harm Alaskan consumers. It's really important that we're able to share those options for lower costs at the pharmacy counter and lower costs for the plan. Senate Bill 129-1 ignores that longstanding value benefit plan design and instead requires a one-size-fits-all mandate design through a series of provisions that eliminate this flexibility, undermining the employer and plan sponsor's ability to determine how to structure their health care spend, will drive up costs for employers and plan sponsors across the state, which will be directly felt by Alaskan consumers. This bill only increases costs, and we respectfully ask for your opposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schneider. You touched on a few things that I opened up with in questions to the bill sponsor, as well as our testifier from the Tanana Chiefs Conference. What would be helpful, if you have it in front of you right now, or you can get it to me later, if from the bill you can just let me know, I am interested to know what lines in the bill ban the use of mail order pharmacies for maintenance drugs.
Okay.
Do you have that? If you have it now, just shout it out.
Yeah, so it's not saying you can't use it. It's saying that you cannot require that. And so that's where plan sponsors are choosing to require that as a way of lowering their cost. And this bill says that plan design cannot be directed with those certain limitations and those restrictions. So yes, they can still use mail, but they can't say you can only use mail for these things. And that's where plan sponsors are able to save costs by directing that they are required to use it in certain kinds of ways.
So are you able to appreciate that the way that you said what you said could very easily be interpreted by a regular person who doesn't understand these concepts or prescription drugs? What I've heard you say and what I've heard surrogates of yours say is that this bill bans mail order delivery for maintenance medication. And I've heard that from a number of people even today. But you agree that this bill does not ban mail order delivery for maintenance drugs?
I will accept that I spoke that with less clarity than I should have, and I apologize for that. This bill does not. Would you like more clarity, or we did?
Yes.
Yeah, as I said earlier, this bill eliminates the ability for a plan sponsor to make those determinations and those requirements.
Thank you.
That would provide them with lower cost options.
And also, you mentioned that this bill eliminates networks. What part?
It effectively does. So as I believe it was Mr. Loudon earlier spoke to, we are able to negotiate that cost with that network pharmacy by saying, hey, we're going to drive more business to you if you agree to lower cost. By saying that any pharmacy should be able to be allowed in the network and anybody is going to be paid exactly the same, there's no ability for that negotiation to take place because there's no incentive for then that pharmacy to agree to that lower cost. And so the whole entire point of that preferred pharmacy network is being able to say, hey, we're going to reduce the number of pharmacies you can go to, but it's going to be an overall cost saver because those pharmacies are agreeing to it because they're having more business, more patients driven to them. And so it's an effective obliteration of the way that pharmacy networks are designed.
And you also mentioned that this bill would outlaw communication somehow. What part of the bill does that?
It's the provisions regarding steerage where we can't steer to lower cost options. If we can't steer, how do we tell them without that being seen as steering?
Understood. I think having a mandate would be part of that, but I understand what you're saying. Thank you. All right, we'll hear from one more person, and then we're going to wrap up for today. Next up, we have Gary Stranigan.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Stranigan here from Primera Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Alaska, testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 121. To begin, I want to underscore a few important points. Primera is not owned by, nor do we own a PBM, and we fully support transparency. And furthermore, we share the goal of ensuring fair compensation for pharmacies, and we need them in service of our members, after all. Nevertheless, we are concerned with many of the what we see as anti-free enterprise provisions in Senate Bill 121 that we are concerned will increase costs and make healthcare even less affordable. And believe me when I tell you, I've got a paragraph in each one of these provisions, but I think you've already heard a lot about them already, and happy to talk about perhaps addressing them with amendments offline if there is some degree of receptivity to that. But let me just list them as the non-affiliate pay parity provision that you just spoke with Ms. Snyder about, Mr. Chair, the anti-mandatory mail order provision and anti-steering provisions. And again, we totally understand that that doesn't prohibit mail order. It just prohibits exclusive mail order benefit designs, and I appreciate that distinction. We don't, and by the way, we don't have a mandatory mail order program, but we don't see any reason to restrict this cost reduction tool. Another issue is spread pricing, and I will comment on this just a little bit. Virtually every business on planet Earth exists in some part because it buys a product and sells it for a little bit more, which is a very simplistic way of looking at spread pricing. Now, the prescription drug supply chain is complicated, and every piece of that, every step in that chain takes a spread. And most of them are not impacted by this bill. PBMs and carriers are, and that doesn't seem to be even handed. It's also important to know that pharmacies have their own version of a PBM, which is not impacted by the bill, and hospitals have their own 340B program, which charges an average markup of 600%. And hospitals not in that program mark up their drugs an average of 240%. This provision would lead us in some instances to charge as much as a 10% increase in premium. So it's an important provision to address. We also have concerns with the white bagging and brown bagging provisions in the bill. These are programs that are intended to address sometimes abusive prescription drug markups in clinical settings. We don't use them in Alaska now, but we wouldn't like to be prohibited from doing so in case it makes sense to our members at some future time. And finally, on the dispensing fees provision in Section 9, this is government setting a price for a service that is currently subject to the competitive pressure and accountability of the marketplace. And testimony in support of the bill, proponents indicated that this would play the role of economic development and contribute an additional $50 million to the local economy. And how can this be interpreted any other way than to increase healthcare costs? The money has to come from somewhere. So I hope that's treated with some sober-minded consideration. And I want to disclose that not-for-profit health plans like Premera utilize PBMs because we haven't figured out a better way to build the mousetrap. We need their negotiating power to apply downward pressure and accountability on the sometimes unscrupulous prescription drug manufacturers. A key concern with this legislation is that it is imbalanced and would increase the power of those manufacturers to extract more money from our members by undermining the PBMs. So I just want to commend the chair and the committee for their engagement on this bill and the serious questions and this the degree of acuity with which you're focusing on it. And it is important to know, though, that this bill hasn't been vetted. And apart from the few that were invited to participate in the work group that we learned about in a previous hearing on the bill, these hearings were the first that we've really had a chance to dig into it. And developing legislation like that in isolation is problematic because it benefits one constituency or two, in this case, the pharmacists and the prescription drug manufacturers. And
Mr. Stranigan, we're going to I'd like to get a member of the public to testify here. Oh. So if you just have a closing comment and wrap up, that would be good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to my wrap up was next. I do want to underscore the appreciation for having this hearing and fleshing out, surfacing more resistance to the bill so that the citizens of Alaska can, in the end, get a better product. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. And what I would encourage Primera and CVS Caremark and others to do is show the committee what you collected in prescription drug costs for the last year and compare that with the NADAC average. It's a rolling average that gets rebased every week. We just fought a very long battle of the 80th percentile rule against a rolling average that got rebased twice a year. And we know what kind of escalator that was.
Sure.
So, yeah, let's take a look back and see. Let's look at the real numbers. We can do that on the plan side as well as the provider side. Okay, thank you. Lori Morton.
Thank you for fitting me in this afternoon, Senator.
You're welcome, ma'am.
Good afternoon. My name is Lori Morton. I live in Juneau and Senator Keel's district. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, but I've taken work time off today and speaking on my own behalf. I don't often find myself as being in the position of the little person, but I think that's what I am today. I support Senate Bill 121. Local pharmacies are more than a place to fill prescriptions. They're about relationships. I want to go to a pharmacist who gets to know me and my medications, who has an interest in how I can incorporate those medications into my lifestyle. I want to see pharmacy staff who can help me with non-prescription medications or help me select the proper medical gear. I want a place I can trust where qualified people can give me appropriate vaccinations. I want to support my Alaskan neighbors who want to practice their chosen profession in Alaska. I am one of those hardworking women that somebody spoke about earlier, and I've seen the fiscal notes, and I don't actually mind paying more if paying more means we keep Alaskan businesses open and consumers get personalized attention. Maybe from the testimony you're hearing one way or the other, it's going to cost more or it's going to cost less. The important thing is that we keep it here at the local level. Senate Bill 121 is also about patient choice. I want choice. It talks about that in Section 10 of the bill. My doctor should be the one working with me to decide which medications are best for me, not a PBM or an insurer that might state a medication my doctor has decided is best is not on an improved list somewhere, or the pharmacy I choose can't provide it. Regulating regulators is important. I think you've heard from a lot of regulators today. PBMs need structure to which they should adhere as much as, or maybe even more so, than the businesses they say they monitor for the public's benefit. Senate Bill 121, I don't think, places undue burdens on PBMs. The proposed regulatory practices to which they will be required to follow seems to be put in place to protect consumers and pharmacies working to better meet consumer needs. Thank you for hearing this bill. I hope you look on it favorably and move it from committee. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Morton, for your testimony. That concludes our hearing for today. We will set this bill aside for further consideration, and we will pick up Senate Bill 203 at a later date. My apologies to all the folks who came from the administration to be here for that bill today, but thank you for being here. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, March 13th, when we will hear Senate Bill 196, Employer Drug and Alcohol Testing, and Senate Bill 234, Extending the Marijuana Control Board. As there's no further business to come before the committee today, we're adjourned at 3:17 p.m.